Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, the Holy See calls on the international community to immediately help millions of Iraqi refugees and displaced. Christians in Turkey fear more attacks on their tiny community after three Presbyterians are killed at a Bible printing house, and the difficult and increasingly dangerous decision to become Christian. The Holy See is calling on the international community to immediately help millions of Iraqi refugees whose plight could lead to further regional destabilization. The Holy See said comprehensive reconciliation and peace in Iraq are necessary to address the root cause of this forced displacement. The appeal came at a UN conference in Geneva this week, where delegates agreed to increase help for the 4 million Iraqi refugees and displaced people, who are now leaving their homes to escape the violence at a rate of 50,000 people a month. Up to half of the refugees are being sheltered in Iraq's neighbors, Syria and Jordan. The other half are displaced across Iraq. Susie Hodges picks up the story.
The UNHCR says it was high time the alarm was sounded about this massive and worsening humanitarian crisis. Among those who attended the UN conference was Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, and it was he who made the appeal for a greater mobilization on the part of the international community in his address to the gathering. He welcomed the fact that the global spotlight is being shone on this long-neglected humanitarian crisis, but said there was disappointment in some quarters about the amount of financial aid being promised so far.
There is a hope that as a result of this heightened awareness, governments and private sources would deliver more funds so that the emergency needs can be met. Although the conference was not a pledging conference, there was the expectation that some public commitment would have been made in higher figures than what has been done. Much of the attention has been focusing on the violence, the daily killings, the bombs, the suicide bombers, and the people who have been forcibly displaced due to some kind of ethnic cleansing on the part of extremist groups, or because life had become impossible for them, were left in the shadow. And now, finally, the spotlight has turned on them, and we hope that as a result, there will be a positive response on the part of the international community.
Does the Holy See feel that the US, Britain, and other allied countries who currently have troops inside Iraq have a particularly pressing moral imperative to help shoulder the burden of caring for these refugees and displaced people?
The responsibility for this kind of humanitarian response rests with everyone in the world, the whole international community. It seems to me that those who are more directly involved in the political future of Iraq have a more at stake and therefore a greater possibility and kind of duty to help remedy the situation.
Syria and Jordan are the two neighbouring countries to Iraq who up until now have shouldered most of the burden. But Archbishop Tomasi believes that resettlement of some of the refugees by Western and other nations is an option that should be considered.
The conference praised very much the generosity of Jordan and Syria, who took in almost 1.5 million people between the two countries, and also other countries in the area that have not shut their doors completely. And a preoccupation that has emerged during the conference is that resettlement should be an option for those people who really cannot go back, have no future, and they cannot stay in the countries where they find now temporary refuge. So there is an appeal made to Western countries, but also to others, Latin America, everywhere, to try to take in some of these desperate cases.
Those attending the conference agreed on one thing, that supporting the refugees is only treating the symptoms, not the disease. So what further action does the Holy See believe should be taken to try to find a longer-term solution to the violence now raging in Iraq?
What is needed now is, first of all, an immediate response to the people who are outside Iraq, like in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, some other countries like Turkey or Egypt, so that these people may not be pushed back into Iraq. Second, that they may have enough to eat and a house where to stay, not to create camps for refugees, because there is the risk that then you have protracted situations like the said example of the Palestinian exodus of 1948, whose solution is still not with us. And on the basis of these immediate needs, to create a new spirit, some kind of reconciliation process that will allow the people of Iraq to take up their own responsibility for their own country, for their own neighbors, and begin some kind of a process that lead to peace and to the possibility for these millions of people to go back to their homes.
But just how desperate is the situation for the Iraqi refugees who sought refuge in neighboring countries after fleeing the violence and insecurity in their homeland? How are they coping? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Najla Chada, director of the Caritas Migrant Center in Beirut, who has also recently visited Iraqi refugee projects in Syria and other nearby countries. She believes the international community could have done far more up to now to alleviate the plight of these Iraqi refugees, and says the situation is getting worse every day.
Definitely, the international community has not done enough for Iraqi refugees. Especially lately, we have a huge number of people fleeing Iraq, and there is a big need and concerns for those people. I can give the example of Lebanon. In our center, we were normally receiving 10 families per day. Now we are receiving 100 families per day, and the number are really increasing and increasing each day. A lot of them, they have lost or left all what they own in Iraq.
Najla says living conditions for these Iraqi refugees in Lebanon are often horrendous, with 20 or more people living in a single room.
They are living together in one room, 3 to 4 families, each family of 7 members sometimes. So that makes 24 person living in one room to be able to afford the rent.
The presence of so many Iraqi refugees in Lebanon has helped drive up the price of accommodation and food in the capital. As a result, says Najla, there is some resentment against the new arrivals among the local population.
Most Iraqis are living in poor areas, and that means local people are also facing some problems. So they are not happy with having them. Prices are getting up. So they are blaming Iraqi's community of having this effect. There is not xenophobia against Iraqi community. It's because of the economic impact on daily life. That's why they are a little bit concerned about it.
After Syria, Jordan is the country which has taken in most Iraqi refugees over the past 3 years and now has nearly 800,000 there. Father Dennis Como is an American priest who helps minister to Iraqi Chaldean Christians in the Jordanian capital, Amman.
Jordan doesn't really have the wealth that any of the other countries has. Has no water, has no oil. And so they try to have the Iraqis keep moving on or going back. So there's no residency for Iraqis. It's sort of like emergency. You can stay here for a very little while, but you should move on or move back. Every day it's a struggle to get, you know, like medical care or to find out where there might be some free food.
As the number of Iraqis has increased in recent months, Father Dennis says Jordan is now starting to close its borders to prevent further arrivals from entering the country.
It's noticeably increased, and as I said, many of the people going to Syria, and so now it's much more difficult for people to come from Syria to Jordan. Before it was just jump in a bus and come, and now it's no.
Many of those Iraqis who fled to neighbouring countries did so after they were threatened or after they or a family member had been physically attacked in Iraq. Najla says most of them are far too afraid to return home.
They are desperate. They are so afraid that they don't want to go back to Iraq. A lot of them were targeted. And there is also people leaving for medical reasons because they are not capable to give treatment for their family, especially cancer cases.
That was Najla Chada, director of the Caritas Migrant Center in Lebanon. And you also heard the voice of Father Dennis Cuomo, an American priest in Amman, and Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva. And I'm Susie Hodges. Christians in Turkey are increasingly alarmed, fearing more attacks on their community. The latest in a series of killings of Christians in the mostly Muslim country came this week when three Presbyterians, a German and two Turks who converted to Christianity, were brutally murdered at the small publishing house in Malatya, where they printed Bibles. On Thursday, police detained 10 young men suspected of tying up the Christians and slitting their throats. The attacks have been widely condemned in Turkey and could, analysts say, deal a blow to the country's bid to join the European Union. While speaking to an Italian news agency, Turkey's ambassador to the Holy See, Doğan Akdoğ, condemned the attack as savage and cruel, carried out by those he called a few fanatics. He pledged that the government will take all necessary measures to protect Turkey's Christian minorities. But this week's murders are by no means the first of Christians in Turkey, or, for that matter, in other countries. Lydia O'Kane spoke to a Middle East consultant for the religious freedom organization Christian Solidarity Worldwide. A Turkish Christian himself, he asked to remain anonymous, so we'll call him Joseph.
Because our work is in Christian Solidarity Worldwide, we regularly hear news of Christians being persecuted all throughout Asia and the Middle East and Africa and Latin America as well. But when news like this come into my inbox and you see the name of a person that you've known for 10 years, of course it brings a really immense personal dimension to the issue. So it's not just random news, but here is somebody whom I attended the same church with, same home group. I know his wife. I know his children. And it breaks my heart because this man was a great, genuine man of God.
Just 5 months ago, Pope Benedict XVI was in Turkey for a historic visit of solidarity with Eastern Christians, particularly the Eastern Orthodox Church. He also met with Muslim leaders in an expression of respect and goodwill. The Pope's visit followed less than a year after a Catholic priest, Andrea Santoro, was murdered in Turkey.
The persecution of Christians has increased significantly for the last century, but intensely a lot more since the 9/11 attacks, just owing it to the larger political culture that we live in. But you're right to point out, in 5th of February 2006, Father Santoro was killed in northern Turkey. On 4th of November the same year, a church in Ödemiş, which is near Izmir, western Turkey, were attacked with Molotov cocktails. On January 2007, another church in northern Turkey, near to the city which Father Santoro was killed, was stoned, and the pastor received death threats. And, of course, the murder of the Armenian editor has hit the international tabloids, rightfully so. But this has been coming. I mean, people have seen this. The people in Malatya, where these two Turkish men and the German men were killed yesterday, have received death threats before. There were protests against them. There were accusations that these people were missionaries. But ironically, the Turkish law gives you the right to share your faith, publish Bibles, and distribute them. So there is no criminal activity these men were ever involved in. But even the wording of the Turkish press all these years have been that the missionary activities in Turkey were just there to divide our nation. And this was echoed by state ministers and officials and local authorities who all said the ultimate goal of the mission activities in the country is to mobilize non-Muslim minorities and rebel and destroy our country. So if the government officials say such things, and these are published regularly in the media, just a month ago, one of the biggest nationwide newspapers in the country published a piece which quoted a local authority that said Christians in Ankara, the capital city, were giving out $100 written in the pages of the Bible. You know, why would anybody do that? At the same time, there are two Turkish Christians who are still waiting a court decision. Last October, they were arrested by gendarme officials under the crimes of, again, missionary activity, which is not a crime. And they were accused with offering sexual experiences with young girls and money. And they were accused with threatening young Muslim men with guns and in the same time insulting the Turkish army and insulting Turkishness. So this has been going on for the last 2 years. And yes, the European Union process have brought some significant changes legally. But as His Holiness the Pope commented after his trip to Turkey last year, the minorities in Turkey have just been really fragile and vulnerable to such scapegoating and targeting for a very long time. So it is no surprise to me or to anybody that this has happened again. And this will happen again unless the state takes proactive responsibility to stop these media attacks, stop these campaigns, and protect her minorities.
There must be a great sense of fear after these killings and after the previous killings.
There is, definitely. If you have read the writings of Hrant, the Armenian journalist, he said he feels like a pigeon walking in the city, walking around in the city. He's looking right and left all the time. And this has increased. And I have spoken to the pastor of the men who were killed today and friends of these people, and they all sat there in shock and they're afraid for their lives. One of the daughters of a pastor actually said to her mom, saying, you know, what if they kill my father this way as well? So these are legitimate fears, and none of the religious minorities in Turkey ask for extravagant rights, such as, you know, open us the biggest church in the Middle East, or give us government funding, or encourage Muslims being Christians. No, what they want is just the most basic human rights. They want to go to their churches without the fear of being attacked, or if that they're attacked, the police will be there to protect them and that government will help them. And they actually don't want to be scapegoated for every single failure of the Middle Eastern politics.
Indeed, it's people going about their daily business. And there are only just, is it 100,000 Christians in a population of 74 million?
Probably. The 100,000 is probably the maximum number that will include Armenian Orthodox Christians as well as the Roman Catholic Christians, Syriac Orthodox Christians and Turkish Protestant Christians. And that feeling alone of being left as such a small minority in the land where Christianity started, it's quite a shock anyway. I mean, if you look into church history, the first place which Christians were called Christians was in Antioch, which is in Turkey. Paul was born in Tarsus, which is in Turkey. All of the seven churches in the book of Revelation are in Turkey. Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat, which is in Turkey. All of the biggest councils of the church history happened in Turkey, and Constantinople was the center of Christian leadership. And even now, the Eastern Orthodox Church has the main ecumenical patriarch in Istanbul. So from that history to this situation is already a big shift, actually.
And our thanks there to Joseph, who asked to be anonymous. He is a Turkish Christian and a Middle East consultant for Christian Solidarity Worldwide. Recently, a Christian was beheaded in India's troubled Kashmir region. Another was killed for his faith in Pakistan. Both were converts from Islam. And as we've seen in Turkey and other nations too, they're part of a disturbing list of Christians dying for their belief. And that list is growing. Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir teaches Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Lebanon.
You remember the story of Abdurrahman, this Afghan from Afghanistan, who was working in Germany and then came back 2 years ago when the Taliban left Afghanistan, and he wanted to see his two daughters, and then his own family denounced him as a converted, and he said, yes, I am Christian. And so they decided to kill him as a punishment. And then the West intervened and they asked for his liberation, and finally he was protected and he came to Italy. And they, if he escaped to this punishment, it's because they said he is crazy. He does not know what he is doing, because becoming Christian is means to be crazy.
Does this mean that all Islamic law says it's okay to kill a Muslim who converts to Christianity? Who'd be crazy enough to do it then? Father Samir says that's too simplistic. It depends on who is interpreting what in Islam.
In the Quran, we find 14 verses speaking about this situation. It's always considered as something very bad, but never, never we find a condemnation to death. And this is the difference between the Sharia and the Quran. Quran is the most important pillar of Islam. The Sharia is written 3-4 centuries later and is based on Quran principally, but also on other elements, sayings or deeds of Muhammad. And we are never sure that these sayings attributed to Muhammad are really from him. The fact is that we don't find a single verse condemning an apostate to death. But in fact, they decided.
Who wrote the Sharia? You say it was written 3 or 4 centuries after the Quran, which would have put it, the Sharia, in about the year 1000,
The 9th, 10th century. Now, around the year 900. Who wrote it? These are famous jurists. 4 of them are considered as the heads of the 4 Islamic juridical traditions. There is also a 5th one, which is by the Shia, and they call it Ja'fari. And the 4 well-known Sunni jurists created the 4 schools, juridical schools of Islam. Now, these schools are based on the Quran, essentially reinterpreted according to the sayings attributed to Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, and with a personal interpretation.
Father Samir says these interpretations have many Muslim scholars questioning the application of Sharia law in their societies, but they're in conflict with those Muslims who take the more radical view.
The reason why most Muslims consider that an apostate, someone who abandoned Islam to move to another religion, must be killed, is that they say he's a traitor to his nation. And they say, you two in the West, you will kill a spy, for instance, who traitored his own nation and gave secrets to the enemies. So we do the same. But by saying that, by giving this argument, it means that they considered the problem politically, and in fact, is a political question. They say, this punishment aim to make other people reject any move to another religion, essentially to Christianity. So it's a political punishment. And the question is, what do you do with the liberty of conscience? Here is the conflict about this. as I said, many scholars are now discussing this. Most nations, Muslim nations, renounced to kill the apostate, most of them. Out of the 57 nations, if I'm not wrong, only 7 or 8 will apply this rule of the Sharia rigorously. The others will find another punishment. It's always punished. No one, even the secular countries like Turkey and Tunisia, for instance, in these countries, it will be still very difficult to convert from Islam to another religion. They always considered he is a traitor, he must be punished in a way or in another way.
But, Father Samir adds, punishment has a religious element too, taken to the extreme by Muslim radicals.
In the Quran and in the Muslim tradition, the idea of punishment is considered as a purification. We kill him to purify him from his sin. This is the most radical tendency in Islam.
But how representative is this radical element in the Muslim world? Father Samir notes, there is a growing tendency towards fundamentalism, though few Muslims, he says, would resort to the kind of radical violence we've seen over the past couple of decades.
This radicality with violence, these represents a very, very small part of it, less than 1%. But the fact is that the radical tendency push those who are violent to they justify their violence. So you have most Muslims will not agree. 80% will not agree. Maybe 20% will say, well, is justified. But out of these 20%, 99% will never do it. There is an internal conflict between the rule, the Sharia, and that's why they say according to Sharia, he must be killed, and the act itself, they will never do it. But you find some radical, fanatical people who would say, the Sharia says he must be killed, so I do it.
Father Samir wants to see countries in East and West put basic human rights first. And no matter how guilty they may feel for their colonial pasts, he says, European countries should be among the first to spearhead efforts to push for the refining and strengthening of internationally recognized human rights for the dignity of every human being. Thanks there to Father Samir Khalil Samir, who teaches Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Lebanon. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.